Nobody could have slept more soundly than I in the midst of this nightmare. The war, when it came along, made only a sort of faint rumble in my ears. Like my compatriots, I was pacifistic and cannibalistic. The millions who were put away in the carnage passed away in a cloud, much like the Aztecs passed away, and the Incas, and the Red Indians, and the buffaloes. People pretended to be profoundly moved, but they weren't. They were simply tossing fitfully in their sleep. No one lost his appetite, no one got up and rang the fire alarm. The day I first realized that there had been a war was about 6 months or so after the armistice. It was in a streetcar on the 14th Street Crosstown Line. One of our heroes, a Texas lad with a string of medals across his chest, happened to see an officer passing on the sidewalk. The sight of the officer enraged him. He was a sergeant himself, and he probably had good reason to be sore. Anyway, the sight of the officer enraged him so that he got up from his seat and began to bawl the shit out of the government, the army, the civilians, the passengers in the car, everybody and everything. He said if there was ever another war, they couldn't drag him to it with a 20-mule team. He said he'd see every son of a bitch killed before he'd go again himself. He said he didn't give a fuck about the medals they had decorated him with. And to show that he meant it, he ripped them off and threw them out the window. He said if he was ever in a trench with an officer again, he'd shoot him in the back like a dirty dog, and that held good for General Pershing or any other general. He said a lot more, with some fancy cuss words that he'd picked up over there, and nobody opened his trap to gainsay him. And when he got through, I felt for the first time that there had really been a war, and that the man I was listening to had been in it, and that despite his bravery, the war had made him a coward, and that if he did any more killing, it would be wide awake and in cold blood, and nobody would have the guts to send him to the electric chair, because he had performed his duty toward his fellow men, which was to deny his own sacred instincts, and so everything was just and fair, because one crime washes away the other in the name of God, country, and humanity. Peace be with you all. And the second time I experienced the reality of war was when ex-Sergeant Griswold, one of our night messengers, flew off the handle one day and smashed the office to bits at one of the railway stations. They sent him to me to give him the gate, but I didn't have the heart to fire him. He had performed such a beautiful piece of destruction that I felt more like hugging and squeezing him. I was only hoping to Christ he would go up to the 25th floor, or wherever it was that the President and the Vice Presidents had their offices, and mop up the whole bloody gang. But in the name of discipline, and to uphold the bloody farce it was, I had to do something to punish him, or be punished for it myself, and so not knowing what less I could do, I took him off the commission basis and put him back on a salary basis. He took it pretty badly, not realizing exactly where I stood, either for him or against him, and so I got a letter from him pronto, saying that he was going to pay me a visit in a day or two, and that I'd better watch out, because he was going to take it out of my hide. He said he'd come up after office hours, and that if I was afraid, I'd better have some strong-arm men around to look after me. I knew he meant every word he said, and I felt pretty damned quaky when I put the letter down. I waited in for him alone, however, feeling that it would be even more cowardly to ask for protection. It was a strange experience. He must have realized the moment he laid eyes on me that I was a son of a bitch and a lying, stinking hypocrite, as he had called me in his letter. I was only that because he was what he was, which wasn't a hell of a lot better. He must have realized immediately that we were both in the same boat and that the bloody boat was leaking pretty badly. I could see something like that going on in him as he strode forward, outwardly still furious, still foaming at the mouth, but inwardly all spent, all soft and feathery. As for myself, what fear I had vanished the moment I saw him enter. Just being there quiet and alone, and being less strong, less capable of defending myself, gave me the drop on him. Not that I wanted to have the drop on him either, but it had turned out that way, and I took advantage of it, naturally. The moment he sat down, he went soft as putty. He wasn't a man anymore, but just a big child. There must have been millions of them like him, big children with machine guns who could wipe out whole regiments without batting an eyelash. But back in the work trenches, without a weapon, without a clear, visible enemy, they were helpless as ants. Everything revolved about the question of food. The food and the rent. That was all there was to fight about, but there was no way, no clear, visible way to fight for it. It was like seeing an army strong and well-equipped, capable of licking anything in sight, and yet ordered to retreat every day, to retreat and retreat and retreat, because that was the strategic thing to do, even though it meant losing ground, losing guns, losing ammunition, losing food, losing sleep, losing courage, losing life itself, finally. Wherever there were men fighting for food and rent, there was this retreat going on, in the fog, in the night. For no earthly reason except that it was the strategic thing to do. It was eating the heart out of him. To fight was easy, but to fight for food and rent was like fighting an army of ghosts. All you could do was to retreat, and while you retreated, you watched your own brothers getting popped off, one after the other, silently, mysteriously, in the fog, in the dark, and not a thing to do about it. He was so damned confused, so perplexed, so hopelessly muddled and beaten, that he put his head in his arms and wept on my desk. And while he's sobbing like that, suddenly the telephone rings, and it's the vice president's office. Never the vice president himself, but always his office. And they want this man Griswold fired immediately, and I say, "Yes, sir," and I hang up. I don't say anything to Griswold about it, but I walk home with him, and I have dinner with him and his wife and kids. And when I leave him, I say to myself that if I have to fire that guy, somebody's going to pay for it. And anyway, I want to know first where the order comes from and why. And hot and sullen, I go right up to the vice president's office in the morning, and I ask to see the vice president himself, and "Did you give the order?" I ask, and "Why?" And before he has a chance to deny it, or to explain his reason for it, I give him a little war stuff, straight from the shoulder, and where he don't like it and can't take it. And if you don't like it, Mr. Will Twill Dillinger, you can take the job, my job, and his job, and you can shove them up your ass. And like that, I walk out on him. I go back to the slaughterhouse, and I go about my work as usual. I expect, of course, that I'll get the sack before the day's over, but nothing of the kind. No, to my amazement, I get a telephone call from the general manager saying to take it easy, to just calm down a bit, yes, just go easy, don't do anything hasty, we'll look into it, etc. I guess they're still looking into it, because Griswold went on working just as always. In fact, they even promoted him to a clerkship, which was a dirty deal, too, because as a clerk he earned less money than as a messenger. But it saved his pride, and it also took a little more of the spunk out of him, too, no doubt. But that's what happens to a guy when he's just a hero in his sleep. Unless the nightmare is strong enough to wake you up, you go right on retreating, and either you end up on a bench, or you end up as vice president. It's all one and the same, a bloody fucking mess, a farce, a fiasco from start to finish. I know it, as was in it, because I woke up. And when I woke up, I walked out on it. I walked out by the same door that I'd walked in, without as much as a "by your leave, sir." Things take place instantaneously, but there's a long process to be gone through first. What you get when something happens is only the explosion, and the second before that, the spark. But everything happens according to law, and with the full consent and collaboration of the whole cosmos. Before I could get up and explode, the bomb had to be properly prepared, properly primed. After putting things in order for the bastards up above, I had to be taken down from my high horse, had to be kicked around like a football, had to be stepped on, squelched, humiliated, fettered, manacled, made impotent as a jellyfish. All my life I have never wanted for friends, but at this particular period they seemed to spring up around me like mushrooms. I never had a moment to myself. If I went home of a night, hoping to take a rest, somebody would be there, waiting to see me. Sometimes a gang of them would be there, and it didn't seem to make much difference whether I came or not. Each set of friends I made despised the other set. Stanley, for example, despised the whole lot. Ulrich, too, was rather scornful of the others. He had just come back from Europe after an absence of several years. We hadn't seen much of each other since boyhood, and then one day, quite by accident, we met on the street. That day was an important day in my life, because it opened up a new world to me, a world I had often dreamed about, but never hoped to see. I remember vividly that we were standing on the corner of 6th Avenue and 49th Street, toward dusk. I remember it because it seemed utterly incongruous to be listening to a man talking about Mount Etna and Vesuvius and Capri and Pompeii and Morocco and Paris, on the corner of 6th Avenue and 49th Street, Manhattan. I remember the way he looked about as he talked, like a man who hadn't quite realized what he was in for, but who vaguely sensed that he had made a horrible mistake in returning. His eyes seemed to be saying all the time, "This has no value, no value whatever." He didn't say that, however, but just this, over and over, "I'm sure you'd like it. I'm sure it's just the place for you." When he left me, I was in a daze. I couldn't get hold of him again quickly enough. I wanted to hear it all over again, in minute detail. Nothing that I had read about Europe seemed to match this glowing account from my friend's own lips. It seemed all the more miraculous to me in that we had sprung out of the same environment. He had managed it because he had rich friends, and because he knew how to save his money. I had never known anyone who was rich, who had traveled, who had money in the bank. All my friends were like myself, drifting from day to day, and never a thought for the future. O'Mara, yes, he had traveled a bit, almost all over the world, but as a bum, or else in the army, which was even worse than being a bum. My friend Ulrich was the first fellow I had ever met who I could truly say had traveled, and he knew how to talk about his experiences. As a result of that chance encounter on the street, we met frequently thereafter, for a period of several months. He used to call for me in the evening after dinner, and we would stroll through the park, which was nearby. What a thirst I had! Every slightest detail about the other world fascinated me. Even now, years and years since, even now when I know Paris like a book, his picture of Paris is still before my eyes, still vivid, still real. Sometimes, after a rain, riding swiftly through the city in a taxi, I catch fleeting glimpses of this Paris he described. Just momentary snatches, as in passing the Tuileries, perhaps, or a glimpse of Montmartre, of the Sacré-Cœur, through the Rue Lafitte, in the last flush of twilight. Just a Brooklyn boy. That was an expression he used sometimes when he felt ashamed of his inability to express himself more adequately. And I was just a Brooklyn boy, too, which is to say one of the last and the least of men. But as I wander about, rubbing elbows with the world, seldom it happens that I meet anyone who can describe so lovingly and faithfully what he has seen and felt. Those nights in Prospect Park with my old friend Ulrich are responsible more than anything else for my being here today. Most of the places he described for me I have still to see. Some of them I shall perhaps never see, but they live inside me, warm and vivid, just as he created them in our rambles through the park. Interwoven with this talk of the other world was the whole body and texture of Lawrence's work. Often, when the park had long been emptied, we were still sitting on a bench discussing the nature of Lawrence's ideas. Looking back on these discussions now, I can see how confused I was, how pitifully ignorant of the true meaning of Lawrence's words. Had I really understood, my life could never have taken the course it did. Most of us live the greater part of our lives submerged. Certainly in my own case, I can say that not until I left America did I emerge above the surface. Perhaps America had nothing to do with it, but the fact remains that I did not open my eyes wide and full and clear until I struck Paris. And perhaps that was only because I had renounced America, renounced my past. My friend Kronsky used to twit me about my euphorias. It was a sly way he had of reminding me, when I was extraordinarily gay, that the morrow would find me depressed. It was true. I had nothing but ups and downs. Long stretches of gloom and melancholy, followed by extravagant bursts of gaiety, of trance-like inspiration. Never a level in which I was myself. It sounds strange to say so, yet I was never myself. I was either anonymous, or the person called Henry Miller, raised to the nth degree. In the latter mood, for instance, I could spill out a whole book to Jaime while riding a trolley car. Jaime, who never suspected me of being anything but a good employment manager. I can see his eyes now as he looked at me one night when I was in one of my states of euphoria. We had boarded the trolley at the Brooklyn Bridge to go to some flat in Greenpoint, where a couple of trollops were waiting to receive us. Jaime had started to talk to me in his usual way about his wife's ovaries. In the first place, he didn't know precisely what ovaries meant, and so I was explaining it to him in crude and simple fashion. In the midst of my explanation, it suddenly seemed so profoundly tragic and ridiculous that Jaime shouldn't know what ovaries were, that I became drunk, as drunk, I mean, as if I had had a quart of whiskey under my belt. From the idea of diseased ovaries, there germinated in one lightning-like flash a sort of tropical growth made up of the most heterogeneous assortment of odds and ends, in the midst of which, securely lodged, tenaciously lodged, I might say, were Dante and Shakespeare. At the same instant, I also suddenly recalled my whole private train of thought, which had begun about the middle of the Brooklyn Bridge, and which suddenly the word ovaries had broken. I realized that everything Jaime had said up till the word ovaries had sieved through me like sand. What I had begun in the middle of the Brooklyn Bridge was what I had begun time and time again in the past, usually when walking to my father's shop, a performance which was repeated day in and day out, as if in a trance. What I had begun, in brief, was a book of the hours, of the tedium and monotony of my life, in the midst of a ferocious activity. Not for years had I thought of this book, which I used to write every day on my way from Delancey Street to Murray Hill. But going over the bridge, the sun setting, the skyscrapers gleaming like phosphorescent cadavers, the remembrance of the past set in. Remembrance of going back and forth over the bridge, going to a job which was death, returning to a home which was a morgue, memorizing Faust, looking down into the cemetery, spitting into the cemetery from the elevated train, the same guard on the platform every morning, an imbecile, the other imbeciles reading their newspapers. New skyscrapers going up, new tombs to work in and die in, the boats passing below, the Fall River line, the Albany Day line. Why am I going to work? What will I do tonight? The warm cunt beside me, and can I work my knuckles into her groin, run away and become a cowboy, try Alaska, the gold mines, get off and turn around, don't die yet, wait another day, a stroke of luck, river, end it, down, down like a corkscrew, head and shoulders in the mud, legs free, fish will come and bite, tomorrow a new life. Where? Anywhere. Why begin again? The same thing everywhere. Death. Death is the solution, but don't die yet. Wait another day. A stroke of luck, a new face, a new friend, millions of chances. You're too young yet. You're melancholy. You don't die yet. Wait another day. A stroke of luck. Fuck anyway. And so on over the bridge into the glass shed, everybody glued together, worms, ants, crawling out of a dead tree and their thoughts crawling out the same way. Maybe, being up high between the two shores, suspended above the traffic, above life and death, on each side the high tombs, tombs blazing with dying sunlight, the river flowing heedlessly, flowing on like time itself, maybe each time I passed up there, something was tugging away at me, urging me to take it in, to announce myself. Anyway, each time I passed on high, I was truly alone, and whenever that happened, the book commenced to write itself, screaming the things which I never breathed, the thoughts I never uttered, the conversations I never held, the hopes, the dreams, the delusions I never admitted. If this, then, was the true self, it was marvelous, and what's more, it seemed never to change, but always to pick up from the last stop, to continue in the same vein, a vein I had struck when I was a child, and went down in the street for the first time alone, and there, frozen into the dirty ice of the gutter, lay a dead cat, the first time I had looked at death and grasped it. From that moment I knew what it was to be isolated. Every object, every living thing and every dead thing, led its independent existence. My thoughts, too, led an independent existence. Suddenly, looking at Jaime and thinking of that strange word, ovaries, now stranger than any word in my whole vocabulary, this feeling of icy isolation came over me, and Jaime sitting beside me was a bullfrog, absolutely a bullfrog, and nothing more. I was jumping from the bridge head first, down into the primeval ooze, the legs clear and waiting for a bite. Like that, Satan had plunged through the heavens, through the solid core of the earth, head down and ramming through to the very hub of the earth, the darkest, densest, hottest pit of hell. I was walking through the Mojave Desert, and the man beside me was waiting for nightfall in order to fall on me and slay me. I was walking again in dreamland, and a man was walking above me on a tightrope, and above him a man was sitting in an airplane spelling letters of smoke in the sky. The woman hanging on my arm was pregnant, and in 6 or 7 years the thing she was carrying inside her would be able to read the letters in the sky, and he or she or it would know that it was a cigarette, and later would smoke the cigarette, perhaps a package a day. In the womb, nails formed on every finger, every toe. You could stop right there, at a toenail, the tiniest toenail imaginable, and you could break your head over it, trying to figure it out. On one side of the ledger are the books man has written, containing such a hodgepodge of wisdom and nonsense, of truth and falsehood, that if one lived to be as old as Methuselah, one couldn't disentangle the mess. On the other side of the ledger, things like toenails, hair, teeth, blood, ovaries, if you will, all incalculable and all written in another kind of ink, in another script, an incomprehensible, undecipherable script. The bullfrog eyes were trained on me like two collar buttons stuck in cold fat. They were stuck in the cold sweat of the primeval ooze. Each collar button was an ovary that had come unglued, an illustration out of the dictionary without benefit of lucubration. Lackluster in the cold yellow fat of the eyeball, each buttoned ovary produced a subterranean chill, the skating rink of hell where men stood upside down in the ice, the legs free and waiting for a bite. Here Dante walked unaccompanied, weighed down by his vision, and through endless circles gradually moving heavenward to be enthroned in his work. Here Shakespeare, with smooth brow, fell into the bottomless reverie of rage to emerge in elegant quartos and innuendos. A glaucous frost of non-comprehension swept clear by gales of laughter. From the hub of the bullfrog's eye radiated clean white spokes of sheer lucidity, not to be annotated or categorized, not to be numbered or defined, but revolving sightless in kaleidoscopic change. Hymie the bullfrog was an ovarian spud generated in the high passage between two shores. For him, the skyscrapers had been built, the wilderness cleared, the Indians massacred, the buffaloes exterminated. For him, the twin cities had been joined by the Brooklyn Bridge, the caissons sunk, the cables strung from tower to tower. For him, men sat upside down in the sky writing words in fire and smoke. For him, the anesthetic was invented, and the high forceps and the big Bertha, which could destroy what the eye could not see. For him, the molecule was broken down, and the atom revealed to be without substance. For him, each night the stars were swept with telescopes, and worlds coming to birth photographed in the act of gestation. For him, the barriers of time and space were set at naught, and all movement, be it the flight of birds or the revolution of the planets, expounded irrefutably and incontestably by the high priests of the depossessed cosmos. Then, as in the middle of the bridge, in the middle of a walk, in the middle always, whether of a book, a conversation, or making love, it was borne in on me again that I had never done what I wanted. And out of not doing what I wanted to do, there grew up inside me this creation which was nothing but an obsessional plant, a sort of choral growth which was expropriating everything, including life itself, until life itself became this which was denied, but which constantly asserted itself, making life and killing life at the same time. I could see it going on after death, like hair growing on a corpse, people saying, death, but the hair still testifying to life, and finally no death but this life of hair and nails, the body gone, the spirit quenched, but in the death something still alive, expropriating space, causing time, creating endless movement. Through love this might happen, or sorrow, or being born with a club foot. The cause nothing, the event everything. In the beginning was the Word. Whatever this was, the Word, disease or creation, it was still running rampant. It would run on and on, outstrip time and space, outlast the angels, unseat God, unhook the universe. Any word contained all words, for him who had become detached through love or sorrow or whatever the cause. In every word, the current ran back to the beginning, which was lost, and which would never be found again, since there was neither beginning nor end, but only that which expressed itself in beginning and end. So, on the Ovarian trolley there was this voyage of man and bullfrog composed of identical stuff, neither better nor less than Dante, but infinitely different, the one not knowing precisely the meaning of anything, the other knowing too precisely the meaning of everything. Hence both lost and confused through beginnings and endings, finally to be deposited at Java or India Street, Greenpoint, there to be carried back into the current of life, so-called, by a couple of sawdust mauls with twitching ovaries of the well-known gastropod variety. What strikes me now as the most wonderful proof of my fitness, or unfitness, for the times, is the fact that nothing people were writing or talking about had any real interest for me. Only the object haunted me, the separate, detached, insignificant thing. It might be a part of the human body, or a staircase in a vaudeville house. It might be a smokestack, or a button I had found in the gutter. Whatever it was, it enabled me to open up, to surrender, to attach my signature. To the life about me, to the people who made up the world I knew, I could not attach my signature. I was as definitely outside their world as a cannibal is outside the bounds of civilized society. I was filled with a perverse love of the thing in itself, not a philosophic attachment, but a passionate, desperately passionate hunger, as if in this discarded, worthless thing which everyone ignored, there was contained the secret of my own regeneration. Living in the midst of a world where there was a plethora of the new, I attached myself to the old. In every object there was a minute particle which particularly claimed my attention. I had a microscopic eye for the blemish, for the grain of ugliness which to me constituted the sole beauty of the object. Whatever set the object apart, or made it unserviceable, or gave it a date, attracted and endeared it to me. If this was perverse, it was also healthy, considering that I was not destined to belong to this world which was springing up about me. Soon I too would become like these objects which I venerated, a thing apart, a non-useful member of society. I was definitely dated, that was certain, and yet I was able to amuse, to instruct, to nourish, but never to be accepted in a genuine way. When I wished to, when I had the itch, I could single out any man in any stratum of society and make him listen to me. I could hold him spellbound if I chose, but like a magician or a sorcerer, only as long as the spirit was in me. At bottom, I sensed in others a distrust, an uneasiness, an antagonism which, because it was instinctive, was irremediable. I should have been a clown. It would have afforded me the widest range of expression. But I underestimated the profession. Had I become a clown, or even a vaudeville entertainer, I would have been famous. People would have appreciated me precisely because they would not have understood, but they would have understood that I was not to be understood. That would have been a relief, to say the least. It was always a source of amazement to me how easily people could become riled just listening to me talk. Perhaps my speech was somewhat extravagant, though often it happened when I was holding myself in with main force. The turn of a phrase, the choice of an unfortunate adjective, the facility with which the words came to my lips, the allusions to subjects which were taboo, everything conspired to set me off as an outlaw, as an enemy of society. No matter how well things began, sooner or later they smelled me out. If I were modest and humble, for example, then I was too modest, too humble. If I were gay and spontaneous, bold and reckless, then I was too free, too gay. I could never get myself quite au point with the individual I happened to be talking to. If it were not a question of life and death, everything was life and death to me then. If it was merely a question of passing a pleasant evening at the home of some acquaintance, it was the same thing. There were vibrations emanating from me, overtones and undertones, which charged the atmosphere unpleasantly. Perhaps the whole evening they had been amused by my stories. Perhaps I had them in stitches, as it often happened, and everything seemed to augure well. But sure as fate, something was bound to happen before the evening came to a close, some vibration set loose which made the chandelier ring, or which reminded some sensitive soul of the piss-pot under the bed. Even while the laughter was still dying off, the venom was beginning to make itself felt. "Hope to see you again sometime," they would say, but the wet, limp hand which was extended would belie the words. Persona non grata. Jesus, how clear it seems to me now. No pick and choice possible. I had to take what was to hand and learn to like it. I had to learn to live with the scum, to swim like a sewer rat, or be drowned. If you elect to join the herd, you are immune. To be accepted and appreciated, you must nullify yourself, make yourself indistinguishable from the herd. You may dream if you dream alike, but if you dream something different, you are not an America, of America American, but a Hottentot in Africa, or a Kalmuck, or a chimpanzee. The moment you have a different thought, you cease to be an American, and the moment you become something different, you find yourself in Alaska, or Easter Island, or Iceland. Am I saying this with rancor, with envy, with malice? Perhaps. Perhaps I regret not having been able to become an American. Perhaps. In my zeal now, which is again American, I am about to give birth to a monstrous edifice, a skyscraper, which will last undoubtedly long after the other skyscrapers have vanished, but which will vanish too when that which produced it disappears. Everything American will disappear one day, more completely than that which was Greek, or Roman, or Egyptian. This is one of the ideas which pushed me outside the warm, comfortable bloodstream, where buffaloes all we once grazed in peace. An idea that has caused me infinite sorrow, for not to belong to something enduring is the last agony. But I am not a buffalo, and I have no desire to be one. I am not even a spiritual buffalo. I have slipped away to rejoin an older stream of consciousness, a race antecedent to the buffaloes, a race that will survive the buffalo. All things, all objects, animate or inanimate, that are different, are veined with ineradicable traits. What is me is ineradicable, because it is different. This is a skyscraper, as I said, but it is different from the usual skyscraper à l'américain. In this skyscraper there are no elevators, no 73rd-story windows to jump from. If you get tired of climbing, you are shit out of luck. There is no slot directory in the main lobby. If you are searching for somebody, you will have to search. If you want a drink, you will have to go out and get it. There are no soda fountains in this building, and no cigar stores, and no telephone booths. All the other skyscrapers have what you want. This one contains nothing but what I want, what I like. And somewhere in this skyscraper, Valeska has her being. And we're going to get to her when the spirit move me. For the time being, she's all right, Valeska, seeing as how she's 6 feet under, and by now perhaps picked clean by the worms. When she was in the flesh, she was picked clean, too, by the human worms who have no respect for anything which has a different tint, a different odor. The sad thing about Valeska was the fact that she had nigger blood in her veins. It was depressing for everybody around her. She made you aware of it whether you wished to be or no. The nigger blood, as I say, and the fact that her mother was a trollop. The mother was white, of course. Who the father was, nobody knew, not even Valeska herself. Everything was going along smoothly until the day an officious little Jew from the vice president's office happened to espy her. He was horrified, so he informed me confidentially, to think that I had employed a colored person as my secretary. He spoke as though she might contaminate the messengers. The next day I was put on the carpet. It was exactly as though I had committed sacrilege. Of course I pretended that I hadn't observed anything unusual about her, except that she was extremely intelligent and extremely capable. Finally, the president himself stepped in. There was a short interview between him and Valeska, during which he very diplomatically proposed to give her a better position in Havana. No talk of the blood taint. Simply that her services had been altogether remarkable, and that they would like to promote her to Havana. Valeska came back to the office in a rage. When she was angry, she was magnificent. She said she wouldn't budge. Steve Romero and Jaime were there at the time, and we all went out to dinner together. During the course of the evening, we got a bit tight. Valeska's tongue was wagging. On the way home, she told me that she was going to put up a fight. She wanted to know if it would endanger my job. I told her quietly that if she were fired, I would quit too. She pretended not to believe it at first. I said I meant it, that I didn't care what happened. She seemed to be unduly impressed. She took me by the two hands, and she held them very gently, the tears rolling down her cheeks. That was the beginning of things. I think it was the very next day that I slipped her a note saying that I was crazy about her. She read the note sitting opposite me, and when she was through, she looked me square in the eye and said she didn't believe it. But we went to dinner again that night, and we had more to drink, and we danced, and while we were dancing, she pressed herself against me lasciviously. It was just the time, as luck would have it, that my wife was getting ready to have another abortion. I was telling Valeska about it as we danced. On the way home, she suddenly said, "Why don't you let me lend you $100? The next night, I brought her home to dinner, and I let her hand the wife the $100. I was amazed how well the two of them got along. Before the evening was over, it was agreed upon that Valeska would come to the house the day of the abortion and take care of the kid. The day came, and I gave Valeska the afternoon off. About an hour after she had left, I suddenly decided that I would take the afternoon off also. I started toward the burlesque on 14th Street. When I was about a block from the theater, I suddenly changed my mind. It was just the thought that if anything happened, if the wife were to kick off, I wouldn't feel so damn good having spent the afternoon at the burlesque. I walked around a bit, in and out of the penny arcades, and then I started homeward. It's strange how things turn out. Trying to amuse the kid, I suddenly remembered a trick my grandfather had shown me when I was a child. You take the dominoes, and you make tall battleships out of them. Then you gently pull the tablecloth on which the battleships are floating until they come to the edge of the table, when suddenly you give a brisk tug, and they fall onto the floor. We tried it over and over again, the three of us, until the kid got so sleepy that she toddled off to the next room and fell asleep. The dominoes were lying all over the floor, and the tablecloth was on the floor, too. Suddenly Valeska was leaning against the table, her tongue halfway down my throat, my hand between her legs. As I laid her back on the table, she twined her legs around me. I could feel one of the dominoes under my feet, part of the fleet that we had destroyed a dozen times or more. I thought of my grandfather sitting on the bench, the way he had warned my mother one day that I was too young to be reading so much, the pensive look in his eyes as he pressed the hot iron against the wet seam of a coat. I thought of the attack on San Juan Hill, which the Rough Riders had made, the picture of Teddy charging at the head of his volunteers and the big book which I used to read beside the workbench. I thought of the battleship Maine that floated over my bed in the little room with the iron-barred window, and of Admiral Dewey, and of Sly and Samson. I thought of the trip to the Navy Yard, which I never made because on the way my father suddenly remembered that we had to call on the doctor that afternoon, and when I left the doctor's office I didn't have any more tonsils, nor any more faith in human beings. We had hardly finished when the bell rang, and it was my wife coming home from the slaughterhouse. I was still buttoning my fly as I went through the hall to open the gate. She was as white as flour. She looked as though she'd never be able to go through another one. We put her to bed, and then we gathered up the dominoes and put the tablecloth back on the table. Just the other night, in a bistro, as I was going to the toilet, I happened to pass two old fellows playing dominoes. I had to stop a moment and pick up a domino. The feeling of it immediately brought back the battleships, the clatter they made when they fell on the floor. And with the battleships, my lost tonsils and my faith in human beings gone. So that every time I walked over the Brooklyn Bridge and looked down toward the Navy Yard, I felt as though my guts were dropping out. Way up there, suspended between the two shores, I felt always as though I were hanging over a void. Up there, everything that had ever happened to me seemed unreal, and worse than unreal, unnecessary. Instead of joining me to life, to men, to the activity of men, the bridge seemed to break all connections. If I walked toward the one shore or the other, it made no difference. Either way was hell. Somehow I had managed to sever my connection with the world that human hands and human minds were creating. Perhaps my grandfather was right. Perhaps I was spoiled in the bud by the books I read. But it is ages since books have claimed me. For a long time now I have practically ceased to read, but the taint is still there. Now people are books to me. I read them from cover to cover and toss them aside. I devour them, one after the other. And the more I read, the more insatiable I become. There is no limit to it. There could be no end, and there was none. until inside me a bridge began to form which united me again with the current of life from which, as a child, I had been separated. A terrible sense of desolation. It hung over me for years. If I were to believe in the stars, I should have to believe that I was completely under the reign of Saturn. Everything that happened to me happened too late to mean much to me. It was even so with my birth. Slated for Christmas, I was born a half hour too late. It always seemed to me that I was meant to be the sort of individual that one is destined to be by virtue of being born on the 25th day of December. Admiral Dewey was born on that day, and so was Jesus Christ. Perhaps Krishnamurti, too, for all I know. Anyway, that's the sort of guy I was intended to be. But due to the fact that my mother had a clutching womb, that she held me in her grip like an octopus, I came out under another configuration, with a bad setup, in other words. They say, the astrologers, I mean, that it will get better and better for me as I go on. The future, in fact, is supposed to be quite glorious. But what do I care about the future? It would have been better if my mother had tripped on the stairs the morning of the 25th of December and broken her neck. That would have given me a fair start. When I try to think, therefore, of where the break occurred, I keep putting it back, further and further, until there is no other way of accounting for it than by the retarded hour of birth. Even my mother, with her caustic tongue, seemed to understand it somewhat. "Always dragging behind, like a cow's tail," that's how she characterized me. But is it my fault that she held me locked inside her until the hour had passed? Destiny had prepared me to be such and such a person. The stars were in the right conjunction, and I was right with the stars and kicking to get out. But I had no choice about the mother who was to deliver me. Perhaps I was lucky not to have been born an idiot, considering all the circumstances. One thing seems clear, however, and this is a hangover from the 25th, that I was born with a crucifixion complex. That is, to be more precise, I was born a fanatic. Fanatic! I remember that word being hurled at me from early childhood on, by my parents especially. What is a fanatic? One who believes passionately and acts desperately upon what he believes. I was always believing in something, and so getting into trouble. The more my hands were slapped, the more firmly I believed. I believed, and the rest of the world did not. If it were only a question of enduring punishment, one could go on believing till the end. But the way of the world is more insidious than that. Instead of being punished, you are undermined, hollowed out, the ground taken from under your feet. It isn't even treachery what I have in mind. Treachery is understandable and combatible. No, it is something worse, something less than treachery. It's a negativism that causes you to overreach yourself. You are perpetually spending your energy in the act of balancing yourself. You are seized with a sort of spiritual vertigo. You totter on the brink, your hair stands on end, you can't believe that beneath your feet lies an immeasurable abyss. It comes about through excess of enthusiasm, through a passionate desire to embrace people, to show them your love. The more you reach out toward the world, the more the world retreats. Nobody wants real love, real hatred. Nobody wants you to put your hand in his sacred entrails. That's only for the priest in the hour of sacrifice. While you live, while the blood's still warm, you are to pretend that there is no such thing as blood, and no such thing as a skeleton beneath the covering of flesh. Keep off the grass. That's the motto by which people live. If you continue this balancing at the edge of the abyss long enough, you become very, very adept. No matter which way you are pushed, you always right yourself. Being in constant trim, you develop a ferocious gaiety, an unnatural gaiety, I might say. There are only two peoples in the world today who understand the meaning of such a statement, the Jews and the Chinese. If it happens that you are neither of these, you find yourself in a strange predicament. You are always laughing at the wrong moment. You are considered cruel and heartless, when in reality you are only tough and durable. But if you would laugh when others laugh, and weep when they weep, then you must be prepared to die as they die, and live as they live. That means to be right and to get the worst of it at the same time. It means to be dead while you are alive, and alive only when you are dead. In this company, the world always wears a normal aspect, even under the most abnormal conditions. Nothing is right or wrong, but thinking makes it so. You no longer believe in reality, but in thinking. And when you are pushed off the dead end, your thoughts go with you, and they are of no use to you. In a way, in a profound way, I mean, Christ was never pushed off the dead end. At the moment when he was tottering and swaying, as if by a great recoil, this negative backwash rolled up and stayed his death. The whole negative impulse of humanity seemed to coil up into a monstrous, inert mass to create the human integer, the figure one, one and indivisible. There was a resurrection, which is inexplicable unless we accept the fact that men have always been willing and ready to deny their own destiny. The earth rolls on, the stars roll on, but men, the great body of men which makes up the world, are caught in the image of the one and only one. If one isn't crucified, like Christ, if one manages to survive, to go on living above and beyond the sense of desperation and futility, then another curious thing happens. It's as though one had actually died and actually been resurrected again. One lives a supernormal life, like the Chinese. That is to say, one is unnaturally gay, unnaturally healthy, unnaturally indifferent. The tragic sense is gone. One lives on like a flower, a rock, a tree, one with nature and against nature at the same time. If your best friend dies, you don't even bother to go to the funeral. If a man is run down by a streetcar right before your eyes, you keep on walking, just as though nothing had happened. If a war breaks out, you let your friends go to the front, but you yourself take no interest in the slaughter. And so on and so on. Life becomes a spectacle, and if you happen to be an artist, you record the passing show. Loneliness is abolished because all values, your own included, are destroyed. Sympathy alone flourishes, but it is not a human sympathy, a limited sympathy. It is something monstrous and evil. You care so little that you can afford to sacrifice yourself for anybody or anything. At the same time, your interest, your curiosity, develops at an outrageous pace. This, too, is suspect, since it is capable of attaching you to a collar button just as well as to a cause. There is no fundamental, unalterable difference between things. All is flux. All is perishable. The surface of your being is constantly crumbling. Within, however, you grow hard as a diamond. And perhaps it is this hard, magnetic core inside you which attracts others to you willy-nilly. One thing is certain, that when you die and are resurrected, you belong to the earth, and whatever is of the earth is yours inalienably. You become an anomaly of nature, a being without shadow. You will never die again, but only pass away like the phenomena about you. Nothing of this which I am now recording was known to me at the time that I was going through the great change. Everything I endured was in the nature of a preparation for that moment, when putting on my hat one evening, I walked out of the office, out of my hitherto private life, and sought the woman who was to liberate me from a living death. In the light of this, I look back now upon my nocturnal rambles through the streets of New York, the white nights when I walked in my sleep and saw the city in which I was born as one sees things in a mirage. Often it was O'Rourke, the company detective whom I accompanied through the silent streets. Often the snow was on the ground and the air chill and frosty, and O'Rourke talking interminably about thefts, about murders, about love, about human nature, about the golden age. He had a habit, when he was well launched upon a subject, of stopping suddenly in the middle of the street and planting his heavy foot between mine so that I couldn't budge, and then, seizing the lapel of my coat, he would bring his face to mine and talk into my eyes, each word boring in like the turn of a gimlet. I can see again the two of us standing in the middle of a street at 4 in the morning, the wind howling, the snow blowing down, and O'Rourke oblivious of everything but the story he had to get off his chest. Always, as he talked, I remember taking in the surroundings out of the corner of my eye, being aware not of what he was saying, but of the two of us standing in Yorkville, or on Allen Street, or on Broadway. Always it seemed a little crazy to me, the earnestness with which he recounted his banal murder stories in the midst of the greatest muddle of architecture that man had ever created. While he was talking about fingerprints, I might be taking stock of a coping or a cornice on a little red brick building just back of his black hat. I would get to thinking of the day the cornice had been installed, who might be the man who had designed it, and why had he made it so ugly, so like every other lousy, rotten cornice which we had passed from the east side up to Harlem, and beyond Harlem, if we wanted to push on, beyond New York, beyond the Mississippi, beyond the Grand Canyon, beyond the Mojave Desert, everywhere in America where there are buildings for man and woman. It seemed absolutely crazy to me that each day of my life I had to sit and listen to other people's stories, the banal tragedies of poverty and distress, of love and death, of yearning and disillusionment. If, as it happened, there came to me each day at least 50 men, each pouring out his tale of woe, and with each one I had to be silent and receive, it was only natural that at some point along the line I had to close my ears, had to harden my heart. The tiniest little morsel was sufficient for me. I could chew on it and digest it for days and weeks. Yet I was obliged to sit there and be inundated, to get out at night again and receive more, to sleep listening, to dream listening. They streamed in from all over the world, from every stratum of society, speaking a thousand different tongues, worshipping different gods, obeying different laws and customs. The tale of the poorest among them was a huge tome, and yet if each and every one were written out at length, it might all be compressed to the size of the Ten Commandments. It might all be recorded on the back of a postage stamp, like the Lord's Prayer. Each day I was so stretched that my hide seemed to cover the whole world, and when I was alone, when I was no longer obliged to listen, I shrank to the size of a pinpoint. The greatest delight, and it was a rare one, was to walk the streets alone, to walk the streets at night, when no one was abroad, and to reflect on the silence that surrounded me. Millions lying on their backs, dead to the world, their mouths wide open, and nothing but snores emanating from them. Walking amidst the craziest architecture ever invented, wondering why and to what end, if every day from these wretched hovels or magnificent palaces there had to stream forth an army of men itching to unravel their tale of misery. In a year, reckoning it modestly, I received 25,000 tales. In 2 years, 50,000. In 4 years, it would be 100,000. In 10 years, I would be stark mad. Already I knew enough people to populate a good-sized town. What a town it would be, if only they could be gathered together. Would they want skyscrapers? Would they want museums? Would they want libraries? Would they, too, build sewers and bridges and tracks and factories? Would they make the same little cornices of tin, one like another, on, ad infinitum, from Battery Park to the Golden Bay? I doubt it. Only the lash of hunger could stir them. The empty belly, the wild look in the eye, the fear of worse, driving them on. One after the other, all the same, all goaded to desperation, out of the goad and whip of hunger, building the loftiest skyscrapers, the most redoubtable dreadnoughts, making the finest steel, the flimsiest lace, the most delicate glassware. Walking with O'Rourke and hearing nothing but theft, arson, rape, homicide, was like listening to a little motif out of a grand symphony. And just as one can whistle an air of Bach and be thinking of a woman he wants to sleep with, so, listening to O'Rourke, I would be thinking of the moment when he would stop talking and say, "What do you have to eat?" In the midst of the most gruesome murder, I could think of the pork tenderloin which we would be sure to get at a certain place farther up the line, and wonder, too, what sort of vegetables they would have on the side to go with it, and whether I would order pie afterwards, or a custard pudding. It was the same when I slept with my wife now and then. While she was moaning and gibbering, I might be wondering if she had emptied the grounds in the coffee pot, because she had the bad habit of letting things slide, the important things, I mean. Fresh coffee was important, and fresh bacon with the eggs. If she were knocked up again, that would be bad, serious in a way, but more important than that was fresh coffee in the morning and the smell of bacon and eggs. I could put up with heartbreaks and abortions and busted romances, but I had to have something under my belt to carry on, and I wanted something nourishing, something appetizing. I felt exactly like Jesus Christ would have felt if he had been taken down from the cross and not permitted to die in the flesh. I am sure that the shock of crucifixion would have been so great that he would have suffered a complete amnesia as regards humanity. I am certain that after his wounds had healed, he wouldn't have given a damn about the tribulations of mankind, but would have fallen with the greatest relish upon a fresh cup of coffee and a slice of toast, assuming he could have had it. Whoever, through too great love, which is monstrous after all, dies of his misery, is born again to know neither love nor hate, but to enjoy. And this joy of living, because it is unnaturally acquired, is a poison which eventually vitiates the whole world. Whatever is created beyond the normal limits of human suffering acts as a boomerang and brings about destruction. At night the streets of New York reflect the crucifixion and death of Christ. When the snow is on the ground and there is the utmost silence, there comes out of the hideous buildings of New York a music of such sullen despair and bankruptcy as to make the flesh shrivel. No stone was laid upon another with love or reverence. No street was laid for dance or joy. One thing has been added to another in a mad scramble to fill the belly, and the streets smell of empty bellies and full bellies and bellies half full. The streets smell of a hunger which has nothing to do with love. They smell of the belly which is insatiable, and of the creations of the empty belly, which are null and void. In this null and void, in this zero whiteness, I learned to enjoy a sandwich or a collar button. I could study a cornice or a coping with the greatest curiosity while pretending to listen to a tale of human woe. I can remember the dates on certain buildings and the names of the architects who designed them. I can remember the temperature and the velocity of the wind standing at a certain corner. The tale that accompanied it is gone. I can remember that I was even then remembering something else, and I can tell you what it was that I was then remembering, but of what use? There was one man in me which had died, and all that was left were his remembrances. There was another man who was alive, and that man was supposed to be me, myself, but he was alive only as a tree is alive, or a rock, or a beast of the field. Just as the city itself had become a huge tomb in which men struggled to earn a decent death, so my own life came to resemble a tomb which I was constructing out of my own death. I was walking around in a stone forest, the center of which was chaos. Sometimes in the dead center, in the very heart of chaos, I danced, or drank myself silly, or I made love, or I befriended someone, or I planned a new life, but it was all chaos, all stone, and all hopeless and bewildering. Until the time when I would encounter a force strong enough to whirl me out of this mad stone forest, no life would be possible for me, nor could one page be written which would have meaning. Perhaps in reading this one has still the impression of chaos, but this is written from a live center, and what is chaotic is merely peripheral, the tangential shreds, as it were, of a world which no longer concerns me. Only a few months ago, I was standing in the streets of New York, looking about me as years ago I had looked about me. Again I found myself studying the architecture, studying the minute details which only the dislocated eye takes in. But this time it was like coming down from Mars. What race of men is this? I asked myself. What does it mean? And there was no remembrance of suffering, or of the life that was snuffed out in the gutter, only that I was looking upon a strange and incomprehensible world, a world so removed from me that I had the sensation of belonging to another planet. From the top of the Empire State Building, I looked down one night upon the city which I knew from below. There they were, in true perspective, the human ants with whom I had crawled, the human lice with whom I had struggled. They were moving along at a snail's pace, each one doubtless fulfilling his microcosmic destiny. In their fruitless desperation, they had reared this colossal edifice, which was their pride and boast. And from the topmost ceiling of this colossal edifice, they had suspended a string of cages in which the imprisoned canaries warbled their senseless warble. At the very summit of their ambition, there were these little spots of beings warbling away for dear life. In 100 years, I thought to myself, perhaps they would be caging live human beings, gay, demented ones who would sing about the world to come. Perhaps they would breed a race of warblers who would warble while the others worked. Perhaps in every cage there would be a poet or a musician so that life below might flow on unimpeded, one with the stone, one with the forest, a rippling, creaking chaos of null and void. In 1,000 years they might all be demented, workers and poets alike, and everything fall back to ruin, as has happened again and again. Another 1,000 years, or 5,000, or 10,000, exactly where I am standing now to survey the scene, a little boy may open a book in a tongue as yet unheard of, and about this life now passing, a life which the man who wrote the book never experienced, a life with deducted form and rhythm, with beginning and end, and the boy on closing the book will think to himself, what a great race the Americans were, what a marvelous life there had once been on this continent which he is now inhabiting. But no race to come, except perhaps the race of blind poets, will ever be able to imagine the seething chaos out of which this future history was composed. Chaos! A howling chaos! No need to choose a particular day. Any day of my life, back there, would suit. Every day of my life, my tiny, microcosmic life, was a reflection of the outer chaos. Let me think back. At 7:30 the alarm went off. I didn't bounce out of bed. I lay there till 8:30, trying to gain a little more sleep. Sleep. How could I sleep? In the back of my mind was an image of the office where I was already due. I could see Jaime arriving at 8 sharp, the switchboard already buzzing with demands for help, the applicants climbing up the wide wooden stairway, the strong smell of camphor from the dressing room. Why get up and repeat yesterday's song and dance? As fast as I hired them, they dropped out, working my balls off and not even a clean shirt to wear. Mondays I got my allowance from the wife, car fare and lunch money. I was always in debt to her, and she was in debt to the grocer, the butcher, the landlord, and so on. I couldn't be bothered shaving. There wasn't time enough. I put on the torn shirt, gobble up the breakfast, and borrow a nickel for the subway. If she were in a bad mood, I would swindle the money from the news dealer at the subway. I get to the office out of breath, an hour behind time, and 12 calls to make before I even talk to an applicant. While I make 1 call, there are 3 other calls waiting to be answered. I use 2 telephones at once. The switchboard is buzzing. Jaime is sharpening his pencils between calls. McGovern, the doorman, is standing at my elbow to give me a word of advice about one of the applicants, probably a crook who is trying to sneak back under a false name. Behind me the cards and ledgers containing the name of every applicant who had ever passed through the machine. The bad ones are starred in red ink. Some of them have 6 aliases after their names. Meanwhile, the room is crawling like a hive. The room stinks with sweat, dirty feet, old uniforms, camphor, Lysol, bad breaths. Half of them will have to be turned away, not that we don't need them, but that even under the worst conditions, they just won't do. The man in front of my desk, standing at the rail with palsied hands and bleary eyes, is an ex-mayor of New York City. He's 70 now, and would be glad to take anything. He has wonderful letters of recommendation, but we can't take anyone over 45 years of age. 45 in New York is the deadline. The telephone rings, and it's a smooth secretary from the YMCA. Wouldn't I make an exception for a boy who has just walked into his office, a boy who was in the reformatory for 1 year or so? What did he do? He tried to rape his sister. An Italian, of course. O'Mara, my assistant, is putting an applicant through the 3rd degree. He suspects him of being an epileptic. Finally he succeeds, and for good measure the boy throws a fit right there in the office. One of the women faints. A beautiful-looking young woman with a handsome fur around her neck is trying to persuade me to take her on. She's a whore clean through, and I know if I put her on, there'll be hell to pay. She wants to work in a certain building, uptown, because it is near home, she says. Nearing lunchtime, and a few cronies are beginning to drop in. They sit around watching me work, as if it were a vaudeville performance. Kronsky, the medical student, arrives. He says one of the boys I've just hired has Parkinson's disease. I've been so busy I haven't had a chance to go to the toilet. All the telegraph operators, all the managers, suffer from hemorrhoids, so O'Rourke tells me. He's been having electrical massages for the last 2 years, but nothing works. Lunchtime, and there are six of us at the table. Someone will have to pay for me, as usual. We gulp it down and rush back. More calls to make, more applicants to interview. The vice president is raising hell because we can't keep the force up to normal. Every paper in New York and for 20 miles outside New York carries long ads demanding help. All the schools have been canvassed for part-time messengers. All the charity bureaus and relief societies have been invoked. They drop out like flies. Some of them don't even last an hour. It's a human flour mill. And the saddest thing about it is that it's totally unnecessary. But that's not my concern. Mine is to do or die, as Kipling says. I plug on, through one victim after another, the telephone ringing like mad, the place smelling more and more vile, the holes getting bigger and bigger. Each one is a human being, asking for a crust of bread. I have his height, weight, color, religion, education, experience, etc. All the data will go into a ledger, to be filed alphabetically and then chronologically. Names and dates, fingerprints too, if we had the time for it. So that what? So that the American people may enjoy the fastest form of communication known to man? So that they may sell their wares more quickly? So that the moment you drop dead in the street, your next of kin may be apprised immediately, that is to say, within an hour, unless the messenger to whom the telegram is entrusted decides to throw up the job and throw the whole batch of telegrams in the garbage can? 20 million Christmas blanks, all wishing you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, from the directors and president and vice president of the Cosmo-Demonic Telegraph Company, and maybe the telegram reads, "Mother dying, come at once," but the clerk is too busy to notice the message, and if you sue for damages, spiritual damages, there is a legal department trained expressly to meet such emergencies, and so you can be sure that your mother will die, and you will have a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year just the same. The clerk, of course, will be fired, and after a month or so he will come back for a messenger's job, and he will be taken on and put on the night shift near the docks where nobody will recognize him, and his wife will come with the brats to thank the general manager, or perhaps the vice president himself, for the kindness and consideration shown. And then one day everybody will be heartily surprised that said messenger robbed the till, and O'Rourke will be asked to take the night train for Cleveland or Detroit and to track him down even if it costs $10,000. And then the vice president will issue an order that no more Jews are to be hired, but after 3 or 4 days he will let up a bit, because there are nothing but Jews coming for the job. And because it's getting so very tough, and the timber so damned scarce, I'm on the point of hiring a midget from the circus, and I probably would have hired him if he hadn't broken down and confessed that he was a she. And to make it worse, Valeska takes it under her wing, takes it home that night, and under pretense of sympathy, gives it a thorough examination, including a vaginal exploration with the index finger of the right hand. And the midget becomes very amorous, and finally very jealous. It's a trying day, and on the way home I bump into the sister of one of my friends, and she insists on taking me to dinner. After dinner we go to a movie, and in the dark we begin to play with each other, and finally it gets to such a point that we leave the movie and go back to the office where I lay her out on the zinc-covered table in the dressing room. And when I get home, a little after midnight, there's a telephone call from Valeska, and she wants me to hop into the subway immediately and come to her house. It's very urgent. It's an hour's ride, and I'm dead weary, but she said it was urgent, and so I'm on the way. And when I get there I meet her cousin, a rather attractive young woman, who, according to her own story, had just had an affair with a strange man because she was tired of being a virgin. And what was all the fuss about? Why, this, that in her eagerness she had forgotten to take the usual precautions, and maybe now she was pregnant, and then what? They wanted to know what I thought should be done, and I said, nothing. And then Valeska takes me aside, and she asks me if I wouldn't care to sleep with her cousin, to break her in, as it were, so that there wouldn't be a repetition of that sort of thing. The whole thing was cockeyed, and we were all laughing hysterically, and then we began to drink. The only thing they had in the house was Kimmel, and it didn't take much to put us under. And then it got more cockeyed because the two of them began to paw me, and neither one would let the other do anything. The result was I undressed them both and put them to bed, and they fell asleep in each other's arms. And when I walked out toward 5 a.m., I discovered I didn't have a cent in my pocket. And I tried to bum a nickel from a taxi driver, but nothing doing, so finally I took off my fur-lined overcoat, and I gave it to him, for a nickel. When I got home, My wife was awake and sore as hell because I had stayed out so long. We had a hot discussion, and finally I lost my temper, and I clouted her, and she fell on the floor and began to weep and sob, and then the kid woke up, and hearing the wife bawling, she got frightened and began to scream at the top of her lungs. The girl upstairs came running down to see what was the matter. She was in her kimono, and her hair was hanging down her back. In the excitement, she got close to me, and things happened without either of us intending anything to happen. We put the wife to bed with a wet towel around her forehead, and while the girl upstairs was bending over her, I stood behind her, and lifting her kimono, I got it into her, and she stood there a long time, talking a lot of foolish, soothing nonsense. Finally, I climbed into bed with the wife, and to my utter amazement, she began to cuddle up to me, and without saying a word, we locked horns, and we stayed that way until dawn. I should have been worn out, but instead I was wide awake, and I lay there beside her planning to take the day off and look up the whore with the beautiful fur whom I was talking to earlier in the day. After that I began to think about another woman, the wife of one of my friends who always twitted me about my indifference. And then I began to think about one after the other, all those whom I had passed up for one reason or another, until finally I fell sound asleep, and in the midst of it I had a wet dream. At 7:30, the alarm went off as usual. And as usual I looked at my torn shirt hanging over the chair, and I said to myself, "What's the use?" And I turned over. At 8 o'clock the telephone rang, and it was Jaime. "Better get over quickly," he said, "because there's a strike on." And that's how it went, day after day. And there was no reason for it, except that the whole country was cockeyed, and what I relate was going on everywhere, either on a smaller scale or a larger scale, but the same thing everywhere, because it was all chaos and all meaningless. It went on and on that way, day in and day out for almost 5 solid years. The continent itself perpetually racked by cyclones, tornadoes, tidal waves, floods, droughts, blizzards, heat waves, pests, strikes, holdups, assassinations, suicides, a continuous fever and torment, an eruption, a whirlpool. I was like a man sitting in a lighthouse. Below me the wild waves, the rocks, the reefs, the debris of shipwrecked fleets. I could give the danger signal, but I was powerless to avert catastrophe. I breathed danger and catastrophe. At times the sensation of it was so strong that it belched like fire from my nostrils. I longed to be free of it all, and yet I was irresistibly attracted. I was violent and phlegmatic at the same time. I was like the lighthouse itself, secure, in the midst of the most turbulent sea. Beneath me was solid rock, the same shelf of rock on which the towering skyscrapers were reared. My foundations went deep into the earth, and the armature of my body was made of steel, riveted with hot bolts. Above all, I was an eye, a huge searchlight which scoured far and wide, which revolved ceaselessly, pitilessly. This eye, so wide awake, seemed to have made all my other faculties dormant. All my powers were used up in the effort to see, to take in the drama of the world. If I longed for destruction, it was merely that this eye might be extinguished. I longed for an earthquake, for some cataclysm of nature which would plunge the lighthouse into the sea. I wanted a metamorphosis, a change to fish, to leviathan, to destroyer. I wanted the earth to open up, to swallow everything in one engulfing yawn. I wanted to see the city buried fathoms deep in the bosom of the sea. I wanted to sit in a cave and read by candlelight. I wanted that eye extinguished so that I might have a chance to know my own body, my own desires. I wanted to be alone for 1,000 years in order to reflect on what I had seen and heard and in order to forget. I wanted something of the earth which was not of man's doing, something absolutely divorced from the human of which I was surfeited. I wanted something purely terrestrial and absolutely divested of idea. I wanted to feel the blood running back into my veins, even at the cost of annihilation. I wanted to shake the stone and the light out of my system. I wanted the dark fecundity of nature, the deep well of the womb, silence, or else the lapping of the black waters of death. I wanted to be that night which the remorseless eye illuminated, a night diapered with stars and trailing comets. to be of night so frighteningly silent, so utterly incomprehensible and eloquent at the same time. Never more to speak, or to listen, or to think. To be englobed and encompassed, and to encompass and to englobe at the same time. No more pity, no more tenderness. To be human only terrestrially, like a plant, or a worm, or a brook. To be decomposed, divested of light and stone, variable as the molecule, durable as the atom, heartless as the earth itself.